You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is the accomplished pianist and conductor Stephen Drury. Well known as a champion of 20th century music, Drury's repertory extends from Bach, Schubert, and Liszt to the complete piano sonatas of Charles Ives, as well as music by John Cage, Elliot Carter, Frederick Jevsky, John Zorn, Morton Feldman, Gheorghe Ligeti, and Luciano Berio. He has performed throughout the United States, Latin America, Europe, and Asia, taking the sound of dissonances into remote corners of Pakistan, Greenland, and Montana. Recipient of an NEA Solo Recitalist grant, Drury has also been awarded grants from Meet the Composer to commission new works by John Zorn and John Cage, as well as by Terry Riley and Chinnery Ong. He is a longtime teacher at the New England Conservatory of Music. So welcome to All Things Cage, Stephen. It's great to see you.
Thank you, Laura. It's so good to see you over Zoom and hear you over the magic of the interwebs.
It's amazing, isn't it? Stephen and I were just talking. We think it may be about 10 years since we last spoke, which would have been right around Cage's centennial, maybe right after.
That's right.
Stephen has the fortunate, unfortunate position in life in being the go-to person when people have questions about, especially about conducting Cage. And so that phone call to Stephen was in fact about that very thing.
Right.
Stephen, in researching for this program, I had forgotten how prolific you are. Not that I didn't know, because you were a looming character. When I first started working with Cage in the 80s, Cage knew who you were. People knew who you were that long ago. And your discography, just really, just the Cage pieces. I'm not ignoring the other composers. There are many, you know, Christian Wolff. You've played some Feldman, I think. You've done, anyway, I don't want to get
a couple dead folks, too.
A couple of dead folks, right.
You know, there's this Beethoven guy.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And you've done some early stuff. So I don't want to, you know, just think that you are just a Cage person. But this is All Things Cage. So we're going to talk about you and John Cage. And I personally find that a lot of my favorite realizations of works by you have been Cage's works.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
So, yeah. And you've worked with some of the most amazing musicians, other musicians, including, you know, the late David Tudor, which is quite interesting.
Well, no, I never worked with Tudor.
So how did that come about? So talk about that, because that's confusing.
Oh, the record. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, you can put anything on the same record.
I see. So
we could have put Gershwin's piano rolls on that record. That was the Mode's idea, that we do what one would loosely call the piano concertos.
That's right.
And piano and ensemble. And they had, I think it was Tudor coming back out of pianistic retirement to do with the concert. I had a recording that we were working on for Mode of the concerto, the earlier concerto for prepared piano, which I made with Charles Peltz and my ensemble at New England Conservatory. And I think maybe the last thing to be recorded for that record was the late piece 14 for bowed piano, which is ends up being in a soloistic pocket, I guess you would say.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
The piano part, I don't remember the details now, but it's kind of singular or more continuous or has a little bit more profile than the other 13 parts.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all piano solo. I happened to be lucky enough to do two of them and then end up sharing the disc with David Tudor's recording. I did do a project in 2012 that Roger Reynolds had organized in Washington, D.C. called JCDC for J. Cage's centennial, where I reinvestigated Tudor's notations and decisions for Variations 2 for electrified piano, which was the recording of Cage that I grew up on.
Uh-huh.
The I think one of two John Cage LPs the Spokane Public Library had when I discovered Cage through Peter Yates's amazing book. And, you know, listened to that poor LP until I, you know, ground it to dust and then went out and bought my own copy. And of course, David Tudor kept his meticulous notes about how he deciphered. And when I played Variations 2 for the JCDC Festival, I went back, looked at the Tudor's approach and kind of like re-threw the charts, and, but used his approach and used my understanding of how he had electrified the piano. I felt a little, I told the audience at that time, I was concerned that maybe, you know, I was associating myself with David Tudor a little bit too much, that, you know, and this was in Washington, D.C., which will be fairly obscure for those of us not in politics, but I said, I do this, and I'm afraid some of you here might come up to me afterwards and say, you know, Steve, I knew David Tudor. David Tudor was a friend of mine. Steve, you're no David Tudor, riffing on the Dan Quayle comment from the 84 elections. Yeah. But that's as close as I've ever gotten to.
I see.
Wish I had.
That recording is a little misleading because it came out in 97. So I thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, it came out the year after David died. And so, but you played on that recording.
Yes, I played the concerto and the 14.
Right. But not
the concert for piano and orchestra.
Not the concert. Tudor exactly. Yeah. Got it. Okay. Okay. So we can, so that's good. We can cross David Tudor off the list of possibles.
I wish I had, you know, one of the great, we talk about the people I've worked with, the people I haven't worked with that I never knew. I never knew Earl Brown, never met Feldman. I saw him fall asleep in a concert once. I never had a chance to work with David, but, you know, I'm so lucky to remember spending time actually on stage with Merce Cunningham.
Sure.
And I continue to be in touch with Christian, and you know, many people who have had that connection, people like Joe Kubera, who is a wonderful friend of mine, and people, you know, with that. So I've met some good people.
Exactly. No. I'm amazed. I see that you also going back to the works of violin, actually, those two CDs, you have Irvine Arditi on
of
one.
Of course. Of
with
course.
You, which I is so lovely. And then you have you, Irvine, and Mayumi Miyata.
Right. Of course, Mayumi was a different recording again than I was. So I think I've swapped some emails with her about maybe tuning of the show or something. But never met her in person.
For our listening audience, that was the piece was 2-4, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was 2-4, which can be played with violin and piano or violin and show.
Right.
And
right.
So what Stephen is saying here is that he didn't play with Mayumi Miyata because she was the or.
Yes, so, exactly. They're two different versions. Here's a regret. I had premiered that with Paul Zukofsky in Washington, D.C., at the Library of Congress, who commissioned it. And talking to John afterwards, he said some issues about whether or not to use the pedal. And he said, you know, I'd like to hear it sometime with the pedal. I made the appointment. Somehow our communication got switched up. He showed up at the place that I had expected him the day after. I didn't call when I was waiting for him, and that was, we never connected on it, and that was the last.
No, boo.
Last time we were in touch.
Huh? Because 2-4. What year is that?
It's very late. 90, 91.
92.
Yeah.
It's the year he died.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So that would be. Yeah. I wonder if that's his last number piece. Do you think it is?
I just was told that, and I again, historians can.
Oh, there's
share my quibbles that the cello piece 1-8.
I was just going to say there's a 1-8, and I think there's a 1-9. I think that's his vocal piece, or maybe that's 1-7.
That I the numbers, man. That was the only problem with John. You know, I remember so clearly he when the number of pieces were fairly new, and he two was the first of those for flute and piano, and then he talked about writing this the whatever the second two was.
It would be 2-2.
Yeah, I guess it would be. Or so
you
one of the
know, like you want to know what was.
Well, he said, I didn't know what to call it because I'd already written a two. And then I thought, oh, I could just put the superscript,
yeah,
the two to the set. And he was so delighted with himself for coming up with that idea. Of course, now we don't know what to call them.
We call them 2-2. I would say 2-2.
Two, two. Yeah. I usually revert to two for the second time.
Yeah. 2-2. But I'm going to tell you, it was composed, 2-2 was composed in 89. And that was...
Maybe it was 1-2 or 1... I don't remember, but one of the second iteration of one of the number pieces. Probably 5, because that was the one that he did so much. I don't know.
We could look these all up. 5-2 was 91.
Yeah, but the simplest thing. He took such delight in this tiny little.
Well, it's elegant, isn't it?
I mean, it is very elegant. Yeah.
While we're on the subject, let's talk about Cage's number pieces, because we haven't done a show about them. And I find the notation for the number pieces, if not always the works, but always the notation, to be mind-blowing. I think it so overthrows the whole concept of, you know, Western common practice notation, you know, to be able to fully notate a work and have it never be repeatable. I find that lovely. I mean,
it's tricky. I mean, I teach, most of my time is teaching, so I teach these pieces a lot. I teach performance of them a lot, and to get performers who haven't seen this stuff to understand the way the brackets function, that the two timings on the left of the note are actually the range that you can start rather than it goes from here to here.
Exactly.
And to get them past that first knee-jerk reaction of just reading numbers. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, then it's great fun to touch on the fact that the brackets always overlap internally, which means if you could travel the speed of light, you could play a note backwards and have it last minus 10 seconds. And then to look at the evolution of the structure of the brackets, how it starts with fairly simple outline, and there's always one bracket in the middle that's fixed. And then over the course of the number pieces, watch the way the brackets are structured. Especially in the larger ensembles, how the overlaps, he evolves the overlapping situations. You can even find misprints.
No.
A couple, and you know, who knows whether they're engraved misprints or slip of the pen or calculation, but you know, someday I'll go back to school, and first I have to earn my master's, and then when I go out and get my PhD, I can write a thesis on the number. But just to find the way that he evolved these things, which you can't decipher by hearing, but end up creating this incredible thicket.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. For our listening audience, let me interrupt you very quickly. For our listening audience, the number pieces by John Cage are works that evolved in the last roughly 8 years of his life, give or take, 7-8 years. He wrote 43 such pieces that use time bracket notation that may or may not be called by a number. The number pieces, generally speaking, are titled with numbers that denote the number of players, sometimes the number of parts. You have to be careful, because like 4-2 is for a chorus, but it's called 4 because it's soprano, alto, tenor, bass, so it's 4 parts, but mostly it's for the number of players. What else can we say about them? They all have this time bracket notation that Stephen was alluding to, either in fixed situation or kind of variable, and they denote ranges in which a player begins to play the material in front of them, or a range of times that they can end. Mm-hmm. So it's not fixed as to where they enter or where they exit. So what this means is that you end up with these pieces that no matter how hard you might try, short of writing out the parts, which has been done by certain people who won't name names, these pieces can never really be played the same way twice because of the vagaries of the person who is permitted to place their materials in ways that they want to. We also have number pieces, don't we, Stephen, that, I was thinking of like the piece, I think it's 4-6, which is the piece, it's an ensemble piece for four players, mm-hmm. and it just gives time brackets with no materials in them. So players choose their own instruments that have durational aspects.
Right. Yeah. There's such a variety within the number piece. I mean, exactly. Some of them are just pure pitches. And of course, the things involving piano, not 14, which is bowed piano, which can sustain, which has its own issues because the piano, the pedal's held down, which means it, even after you quit playing, it keeps ringing.
Right.
And the piano played on the keyboard, you hit a chord, sooner or later, it's going to die away. So the concluding bracket becomes an ideal.
Right, or an idea.
yeah, a philosophical conception, right, rather than realistic. And like you say, some of them, and there's the one that Cage performed, I think it was it with Willie Winant and Leonard Stein, maybe? It's more, you know, do something in this area that kind of along the structure of what you were talking about. One of the pieces that I did with Irvin, the other, I think it's 2-6, had the time brackets and then separate pages of material to put in any of the time brackets. So a time bracket then could be filled with something from any of those extra pages.
That's right. So they just thwart the possibility of repetition. They thwart the idea of masterwork. What's a masterwork in terms of a number piece? You know, how can you ever say that's the best? Because it can always be, you know, bested. I don't know. I find it so Cagean to.
Well, you know, it makes me think of, I think it was Schnabel's. He was talking about what is a masterwork. He's music that I won't remember the elegant way he put it. Music that's better than it could possibly be played. that, you know, the music is better than any possible performance. And I think that's what, you know, that's the measure of greatness in music. That my own very peculiar take on the number pieces. And this is probably, this might have been heresy even to John himself. I'm not at all sure he would agree with this. Probably not, but you know, the composers don't always know. I think of the number pieces in the same context that I think of the late Beethoven sonatas, string quartets, of, you know, Mahler's Ninth, of the late Schubert works, the piano sonatas, the Schwanengesang. I think that there are composers who, as they approach the end of their lives, start consciously or not having an ultimate vision of life, which includes the understanding of death. And this is almost cliche with Mahler Ninth. There's a cliche with the late Beethoven quartets. These are works about death. Then we go back to think about Cage, and Cage was always in a way so matter of fact. And how would someone like that think about death? Well, what happens with death? Nothing. Things stop. You don't move. And you look at the number pieces, especially, but all of them really, but especially the late ones, and they are drones. They are sustained notes with no movement. Even a piece like the late Your Operas, when you put on the needle on the Victrola, you don't hear the sound of Caruso singing, you hear the drone of the Victrola in a way.
Right.
This stillness, I think this was John's way of doing the same thing that Beethoven was doing.
Yeah, Stephen, let's stop there again for the listening audience. So, in the number pieces, there are some, what do you call it, traditions of ways to play. So,
Already, after only 20 years, 30 years.
So, well, though, even for him, though, I mean that if a note is a sustained note, it should be soft. So there are very few sort of angular moves in a number piece in general. And you brought up the Your Operas, and that's a very interesting thing because the Your Operas, we consider those in the number pieces. They don't carry a number title in the normal practice of number pieces, but they are written with time bracket notation. So that really constitutes number pieces. You know what you're saying though is really interesting, Stephen, because did you meet Ken Silverman?
That's a funny story, and I'll try to keep my stories abbreviated. He was at the Harvard Freshman Union giving a talk on biography, and I had a student at that point who was undergraduate at Harvard said, "Hey, you know this guy that's writing a biography on Jen Cage is at Harvard tomorrow." And I went, "Oh my God, I didn't know anything about this." And I go down and I asked a few questions from the audience, and I walked up to him and asked afterwards. He said, "You know, seem to know a lot about Cage's work." I said, "Yeah, I'm pleased to meet you. I'm Stephen Drury." "Oh, okay." So he'd seen my recordings. When he passed away, I saw his obituary on the web, the Facebook page of my old friend from Courier House, Willa Silverman, his daughter, and I never knew that they were related.
Oh, that's so funny. That's so funny.
So I met him briefly.
Reason I brought him up, he once said to me, I don't recall if he actually put this in print, but for our listening audience, he is the author of really the only true biography of Cage. There's one before it, which David Revel's book, which is I don't
Fancy.
it's
It's
fancy.
fancy.
It's fancy. It's not a real, but I don't feel like it's a real biography. But the Ken Silverman is very much in the spirit of biographies. It's a little formal for Cage,
Well,
but
he's a real biographer too.
that's
He wrote the
right.
book on Houdini.
That's right. He also did Cotton Mather. He did
Amazing.
Edgar Allan Poe is actually one of my favorite of his books. But they're all written in the same kind of almost old-fashioned kind of language and. Anyway, but he said about the number pieces. Let's not digress too much here. About the number pieces that he didn't like them because they reminded him of aging and dying. That they were like wheezing. So it was like breath, except it was elongated. It was more like wheezing, which I thought was a little bleak, but in light of what you're saying, I think it maybe that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Well, there's a lot of people that would rather hear the Pathetique Sonata than the final Beethoven's final opus 111 Sonata too.
Right, of course, of
So
course.
deal with it, guys.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, it happens to all of us.
No, but I love that because I think that you and Ken were saying the same thing. He didn't get down to it. And it might be because he was older than us. You know, he himself was closer to death, so that he may have been less able, willing, desirous of looking at his own demise, looking at his own end, maybe.
Well,
So,
I really have a feeling that John would come back and say, no, it's just sounds. But what does he know? He's just the composer.
yeah. Well, it's gonna probably that whole question is going to have to wait to the second or third biography.
Yes, right. When I played 2/6 with Paul Zukofsky in Washington, Paul basically did not put the violin down. He held every time bracket and overlapped them as much as possible, and just, for 2 3 minutes at a stretch, you'd hear, one high E flat or whatever it was. And for how long is it? A 20-minute piece, 30 minutes? I can't remember. And afterwards, John came down to for the Q&A, and the first thing he said to the audience is, "That was an experience which we have not had before."
He loved Paul, but Paul was a handful.
Paul, it was a great treasure, gift, and honor to be able to perform just that one time with Paul. And I have to say, he was the second weirdest person I have ever been in the same room with.
You know,
nobody can hold a candle to Nam June Paik.
Right.
But
I was gonna
Paul
say,
is number
I
two.
I had to ask who was first.
Yeah, Nam June. That was scary.
Yeah, Nam June. You know who else was? Lamont Young.
Never been in the same room.
Yeah. I never knew if he was a motorcycle guy or. He said his hair, his beard was all braided and twisted.
Yeah.
He's still with us though, right?
I believe, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as he's ever been with us, yeah. We're still with him.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so you have so much experience with Cage's music. I have to ask a really mundane question of you. Do you have a favorite of things that you've done? Like, what's your favorite orchestral work?
Boy, you told me you were going to ask that, and I haven't had to come up with a good answer. It's, there's so many aspects of how you could answer that. I mean, there's, you know, the challenge of the Etudes Astralis, of the fact that every piano will make those things ring differently, and then you can observe how that rings and kind of try to be responsive to that and hitting the right notes and knowing that nobody's going to know, but you still want to hit the right notes. That's its own thing. You know, the recording that we made at New England Conservatory, which is my fault, still sitting in the can, of 68, which is the number piece for 68 players. They all have different time brackets and they all have the same pitch for every, it's unison. Mm-hmm. I mean, how in the hell? And to I don't know if, you know, to sit there in the room and hear all these A naturals coming from different places at the same time, to get to the end of the sonatas and interludes after an hour. And then I stole this from James Pritchett. After playing the, you know, the kind of Nirvana-like mandala vision of the two Gemini sonatas, the meditation
the
drones. And then you have sonata number 16, and all of a sudden we're in G major. And Pritchett says it's like the signature of the Western composer. And of course, I'm also thinking, and it's like getting back to the theme in the Goldberg variations. You know, and oh boy, a favorite.
fair enough. So Stephen, that's actually really interesting that you as a performer, I asked you that question less than a half hour ago. So you had a half hour of me chattering at you and making you chatter back, thinking of what you could possibly say on a radio program about a favorite Cage piece. And you,
well,
and all these things came to your mind about, well,
yeah,
this.
I mean, and there's more. You know, I could think of conducting the et cetera, and just sitting in my station where there's three conductors and people scattered all over playing wooden boxes. And then I get two, and then finally a third person sits down and we can beat time. And I don't know what it's going to sound like. And we beat time and we make this wonderful, but that you're flashing me back on my other Cage weird wrong idea, which is
wait. Yeah. I want to just comment for our listeners that,
oh sorry, yeah,
yeah, because it's all well and good that I understand you, but et cetera is this amazing work. I remember the first time I ever heard it performed, and it was so much more than what I thought it would be. Or, you know, that musically, the players are playing on empty cardboard boxes inverted, and they're tapping on them and they're doing things with these boxes. And the fact of the matter is, it's like a symphony of raindrops.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
It's just the most amazing sound. And I never thought to ask him, maybe he was dead before I ever heard the work performed, whether or not he anticipated that, whether or not he knew that it would sound like that.
Well, there's this other heretical theory that I've got, which is not just confined to that. And the other half of et cetera is that the players then freely get up and go to one of the three stations where there's a conductor. And when you have all chairs filled, the conductor starts beating time. Each player has his or her own notation, so it's unpredictable. And the patterns are in loops. So it's this loop that keeps happening.
Interesting.
And what you hear, and there's a tape, and the tape was made in the countryside where Cage was living at the time. And you hear the woods and the rustling, and occasionally in the distance a car pass. This is a tone poem. This is looking back to the 19th century. This is about nature, living in the woods, like Et Cetera Too, which is a related but kind of inverted piece, is a tone poem about living in the city.
Exactly.
Like
versus the movement of the players.
And he's going back to the summation of the tone poems, which is, you know, which you hear in Charles Ives' music, the same way Ives went back to the sonata, which was the summation of Beethoven's music, the same way Beethoven went back to the fugue,
which is,
and so this makes it very easy for me to list the four greatest composers in Western music. Two of them named John, and then there was a Charles and a Ludwig.
I see.
So, but I think that so much of Cage's later stuff is tone poem.
Interesting. I've never thought of it that way, and I will. Now.
And in Et Cetera Too, these orchestra chords, they sound like car horns or tires screeching. It's the city. It's the sound of the city, just as much as Onagera makes the sound of the train engine, or Liszt makes the sound of going down into hell.
Interesting.
There, I got off that topic too.
Yeah, no, I have so many. This gives me so much to think about. I think we're going to listen to 14. At the end of this program, just because I like it so much, and I like the bowed piano, which is it's unique for Cage. You know, he doesn't score for a bowed piano ever. I think this is the only scored piece.
right. It's a beautiful piece. It's so sensuous. But there's another favorite piece, speaking of sensuous, is Ryoanji.
Which is
so just sonically beautiful and evocative. And I asked John once, I said, you know, we hear that and it just sounds so nostalgic and almost mournful. Is that okay? Because, you know, is that like, and he said, those feelings are with you. They're not with the music. There's no problem with that.
Lovely. You know, we did a beautiful, the Ropack Gallery, Thaddeus Ropack Gallery in London, initiated a show of Cage's Ryoanji drawings. This was about really 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. Yeah. And they came to the Cage Trust and wanted us to help them. We loaned them works, of course. But another thing that we did was we created a soundscape to be played during gallery hours of all the Ryoanji recordings we could find. So we did this sort of just one after the other, after the other, after the other. It was looped, you know, of all these different Ryoanji recordings, all these pieces. And it was sensuous. That's a very good way to describe it.
Yeah. Especially the orchestration of the percussion version.
Yeah, did one for 14, 16 instruments, I forget.
At least, yeah. And to take that percussion, his original percussion part, and the way he then turned it into this, you know, large ensemble score, which is so true to this idea of hearing the same sound again and again and realizing it's never the same sound.
Right, exactly. I don't think people think that about Cage. So that would be something for people to listen to. I'm trying to think of what recording that's on. When did you do Ryoanji? Is that on?
It's one of the mode recordings.
Yeah. It's on the Orchestra Works. I think it's just called the Orchestra Works One or something like that.
One or two,
Yeah, maybe it's two because this Ryoanji's fairly late. It's 83 or 85. Ryoanji, for the audience, is the name of a rock garden in Kyoto that Cage was very fond of. And the percussion obbligato part is always played with whatever ensemble plays the work, and it was written for percussion. And it has all these, as Stephen was saying, these repeated sounds that come back, like called.
I mean, it's unpredictable. It's the original percussion part is just quarter notes and quarter rests, and it's just thunk, thunk, thunk. Very slow, and you never know whether you're going to get a couple beats in a row, and there it's only slightly resonant. So, but in his orchestration, which he did later, he took that same part, and each player has a different notation. Each of the 15 or whatever it is players has a different notation of, do you hold a note? Do you play it a little short? Do you gliss? Do you slide up? Do you play it a little before the beat? Do you play it a little bit after the beat? Do you play it, as he says, more or less on the beat? So you get, and you end up hearing the same sound, same chord, because everybody picks their own pitch. The original percussion is unpitched. And you get the same chord over and over again, and you realize that every time it's a little different, and every time it's the same. I mean, it's a great piece to discover what he was after. It's like the silent piece. Every time it's the same, every time it's different.
Of course, of course. We're going to have to go because if we're going to actually have time to play 14,
We're bumping up against the final number bracket here.
that's exactly right. Our time bracket began, and we're getting close to the end of our time bracket where we really need to end. It's been a pleasure, Stephen. It's really been too long since we've been together, and
Can we do this again in 10 years, if
you
not
bet. We
sooner?
can do this
Another
again
10?
sooner than that. We can
Yes.
talk about, something else that you love or hate or are indifferent to. But it's just a great pleasure to hear you talk.
Thank you, Laura. It's such a good pleasure to talk to you too. And let's talk for again soon.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Bye.
Now on to John Cage's 14, one of the later works from the so-called number pieces, composed in the last year of Cage's life and much discussed on tonight's program. The recording is from Mode Records, specifically Mode 57, John Cage, the Piano Concertos, performed by Stephen Drury on bowed piano, wherein the strings are bowed with rosined nylon fishing line rather than struck with hammers activated from the keyboard, and the Calathumpian consort of the New England Conservatory, conducted by Charles Peltz. Enjoy.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.